Okay, what I'd like to do today, to start with, Mr. Hammer mentioned that I travel a lot, and that's true. In fact, as I decided I wanted to share some experiences of what's going on in the lives of some of your brethren in other parts of the world. I look back on it, and it's been more than a year since I've shown slides here, so I said, well, which trip should I show? I could have done this one, I could have done this one, and probably could have picked from about four. But I decided to show you some slides of a trip that I made in August of this year. This should be new to you. And let's see if we can get this going here. Okay, so when I actually presented this up in St. Louis, and one of the elders said, boy, you need to update your calendar if you're still in August of 2019. But I just explained that's the trip that I would like to show you today. So this trip started off in Africa, and I'll show you some slides of there, and then we'll go on to the leadership weekend that we had in the United Kingdom for all of those who were invited from Europe. And then we're going to spend a couple of minutes in the British Museum in London, and then I'll pull some things from the Bible that I think you'll find enriching and I hope encouraging as well. Mrs. McCullough asked me before services today, so what's your topic today? And I said, well, I'm going to talk about Lachish, Africa, Isaiah, war and tribulation. And she said, okay, I need to be going now. But I see she's still there, so that's I didn't scare her off completely. But we're going to hit actually on a lot of those different things. So to start with, this was my itinerary from Europe to get down to East Africa. And it was indeed in East Africa where I started off this trip in August. So you see this is a flight path from Paris. And because the earth is round, you don't see a straight line there. It traces a curve. And we ended up in two small East African countries, the first of which is Burundi. The capital city is Bujumbura. Try saying that at home three times quickly and see if you get your tongue tangled. But this is Bujumbura on the lakes of Lake, on the shores rather, of Lake Tanganyika. Lake Tanganyika is one of the largest, I believe it's the second largest lake in the world by volume. You can usually see across it. But what's amazing about it is that it's extremely deep. It's more than a mile deep throughout a lot of its length. And there's only one lake in the world. So this has more water in it than any of our Great Lakes, for example. And the economy in Burundi depends on fishing. And they also have boats that carry cargo up and down this lake, which is 400 or 500 miles long, goes all the way down to Zambia. So it's one of the poorest countries in the world as well. And I, to my knowledge, our brethren there are the poorest of all of the church members that we have any place in the world. There are other places that are very poverty-stricken as well, but Burundi is probably the poorest, to the point that owning a bicycle is a luxury that very few people can afford. These men are actually earning their living on their bicycles. They're transporting grass. They'll go out in the rural areas. They'll cut grass. They put it on their bicycles, and they bike it into Bujumbura and sell it to people who are raising livestock. So you can imagine you're not going to sell a bike load of grass for very much, but that's what they'll do. And they'll bike as much as 30 miles or 40 miles in a day, and sometimes they'll try and make as many trips as they can. Almost everything can be transported on a bicycle. These are piles of tomatoes that have been very carefully stacked up on the back of this bicycle. And the economy is based on just many, many things are transported, as I said, by bicycle. It's astonishing what you can fit on a bicycle. This was a photo that I took in August, but I've seen beds, entire bed frames on the back of a bicycle. You'll see just about anything. Defies imagination. This is a speed limit sign. They actually do have speed limits in most of these African countries, but nobody pays any attention to them at all, including the authorities. You'll see army vehicles and police vehicles, they're all going just as fast as they can. And so you see some pretty dramatic wrecks on the side of the road. And this was one that we passed every day as we were going in from the capital city out to visit our members. I'm not sure why they named their restaurant Fungus, but I decided I wasn't going to eat there. It may have something to do with mushrooms, but Fungus Ginger just didn't seem like a good name for a restaurant to me. I was assured on this trip, I should have known better. I did know better, actually, but I let myself be convinced that I only needed a sedan to go out in the sticks to visit church members. And so this is one of the several times when we got stuck. I generally make it a rule to rent a four-wheel drive, and that rule will never again be broken, I can tell you, because you don't have to get out and push. And you can see how red the earth is. That's the way much of sub-Saharan Africa is. It's very, very red dirt, a lot of iron content in it. And this is where we were going. We were actually making several church visits. Usually one of the things that I try to do when I make visits to these areas is I'll try to go around and visit each congregation. And if I can't do it all in one trip, then over the course of two or three trips, I'll get around and meet the congregations in their hall. And the reason I'm showing you this photo now is so that you can be aware of a situation that we have in several countries now in Africa where the government has passed laws making it illegal to hold any kind of church-related activity other than in a dedicated church hall. And the reason this is because these are mostly dictatorships, and the dictators want to know exactly where they can get lay their hands on people, not to ordain them either. But if they hear that someone's been fomenting rebellion or saying things that are disloyal or questionable, they want to know where they can find them. So people have been arrested now for holding a Bible study in their own home. In fact, I received a message from one of our members here in Burundi who said he had been arrested. He was sitting and having a Bible study, just half a dozen people in the living room of a member's home, and the police raided the place. Someone had informed on them that they were holding a Bible study. And the man was arrested, taken to jail, and had to pay a very serious bribe. They called it a fine, but it was actually a bribe to the police in order to be let out. This is also the case now in Rwanda. Mr. Mondeli, our elder there, sent me a message saying that he also had been holding a Bible study in the home of one of some members that live quite far away from the rest of the church in Rwanda. And a runner came in quickly out of breath, said, "The police are coming, you've got to scatter." And so that's what they had to do. They had to scatter because they were holding a Bible study in a house, and that's now illegal. What does this mean for us? Well, it means that we're having to build or rent buildings, even for pretty small groups of people, because they cannot meet together on the Sabbath unless they have a dedicated church building. It doesn't have to be something you own, but at least you must rent it, and that has got to be the only use that you use it for these services. So I've had to put in our budget for next year money to methodically, systematically begin where there is a need, put up these small buildings. Now, these buildings don't cost very much by our standards. $2,000 or $3,000, you can build one of these buildings with corrugated tin roof. The walls are made out of, we try to buy fired brick, which won't dissolve if it gets very wet. Sometimes, though, we have to use mud brick, which is the most common material to use, and then we put a solid cement plaster over it to protect it. And buildings like that with good maintenance can last 30 years. So we're having to do this. Now, a side effect of this is we're also having groups that have formed, Sabbath-keeping congregations that were independent before but are too poor to have their own, to put up their own building, they're making contact with us and saying, "We want to explore the possibility of being a part of your association." And one of the motivations for that is they know that we build buildings for the groups that are affiliated with us. And so one of our challenges is going to be now to sort out who's really being drawn to us by God and who's hoping for a handout to have a church hall. Now, it's perfectly understandable why someone would do that, but it is going to be a challenge for us because we've had, now in Burundi, we've had about 8 other small congregational groups who've contacted us, want to meet, want to talk, and I was even warned that even sitting outside of my hotel room with a group of men and talking about things related to the church, we were on the borderline of illegality by doing that because that was a church function, leaders talking about the activities of their church, and we could have been, according to what they told me, we could have been arrested for doing that. Now, we're careful about it, and we trusted God to do what we can't do, and I haven't had any problems there, but that's the situation that some of our church brethren are facing. I think you could qualify this as persecution. When you can sit in your own home with somebody else and read the Bible together and be arrested for that, that's persecution against free practice of Christianity. So here's one of the newer congregations, and this is a hall that we rent for them while we're waiting to be able to put up something a little bit more permanent. And the man dressed in white on the left side is one of the local leaders, and then there's a man in white on the right side. He's the local pastor there, Mr. Nathan Mukishimana. This is another group that I had already visited a couple of times previously. Interesting thing about this group is when I first came to visit them, they had a lattice work on the sides of a building and a roof, but there were no walls. It was just kind of a woven lattice around the edges. And they explained to me what their situation was. They had pooled all of the resources that they were able to find, and they put a down payment down on a piece of land. And they were only able to come up with two-thirds of the price. So the owner said, all right, I'll take the two-thirds, and you can put up partial walls on the outside and a roof to keep the rain out, but you can't complete your building until I get the rest of my money. That was the deal. So when I was there, it was open on all sides, all around, and we had a meeting, and I met with their local leaders, and we discussed the things, and I was able to give them the other third that they needed to purchase outright the land. The other third cost $200, so their plot was $600 in all. I gave them $200, and when I got there this time, they actually had completed the walls with mud, which is typical. That's what all of their houses are made out of, mud brick, but it's solid. You can see that the rain won't blow in, and chickens won't wander through like was happening previously. And what you see hanging from the roof structure, that's flowers. That's the best they can do for decoration, and they try to make it as attractive as they can. So this is a church hall that's just got a mud floor. It's made out of mud, got a corrugated. Actually, they don't even have tin on the roof yet. It's just leaves on the roof. And they were thanking me over and over again for the help that the church provided for them to be able to meet, have a place to meet in the dry during the Sabbath day. And they welcomed me with dancing and all of the... They have the same format of church service as we do. So they sing hymns and they have a couple of messages and announcements. They follow our format. But outside of the official church service, they do what they like, and that is a lot of singing and dancing and celebrating. And I can tell you it was rather humbling for them to be just so thankful for a dirt floor, dirt mud brick structure with leaves for a roof, and yet they were just so very thankful for that because they hadn't been able to have that previously. This is the situation that many of our brethren are living through right now. This is another one. This is in Chibitoke. This is another relatively new group, but they've been attending with us now for a couple of years. And this was the temporary structure that we had put up with them on a piece of property that we purchased. And I was able, on my last trip in August, I left money with them then to be able to put up a permanent structure. So it was $2,000 to finish off this building for them, and they now have a full house. I don't have a picture of it yet because that was done in my absence, but Mr. Mukesh Imana there has taken care. He's the one on the right of putting up a solid structure for them. So they're very, very thankful to be able to have a place where they can legally meet on the Sabbath and not have to worry about being arrested. One of the things I do when I go into this area is I always try to have at least one or two or sometimes 3 days of leadership training with the local congregational leaders. We actually now have 8 congregations that are either fully a part of Kagwa or are in the introductory process. They accept Mr. Mukesh Imana as their pastor and work cooperatively with him. He tells me that he's talked with them and they understand the Sabbath. They're beginning to keep the holy days. And he assures me that in his view, they're very sincere in their beliefs and in what they practice. But because many of these groups are very new, even their leaders don't know everything that we believe. So it's important for me to sit down with the congregational leaders. And we do things like go through our fundamental beliefs. I go through the leadership manual that's been prepared by our headquarters office. And gradually we try to give them the training that they need so that they can serve the brethren in their area, the areas for which they're responsible. These are some ladies from the congregation in Mugina who've prepared lunch for everyone. Most of these men come on foot. Sometimes they'll ask for a little bit of money to be able to take a bush taxi back home again afterwards. But some of the men who come for these leadership training sessions, they may have walked as much as 15 miles to get there. So we want to make sure at least we give them a good meal before they head for home. And for most people in Burundi, the protein that they eat is going to be some mix of rice and beans. That makes a protein. Most of their protein is vegetable protein. I've asked them in the past there, how often do you eat meat? And they said, well, on average, probably once or twice a year. That's how often that they're able to afford meat. So when we come in and give them just actually what for us would be a small piece of beef or chicken, that's a huge treat for them and not something that they can have normally. And these ladies have prepared that for the lunch. And here they are eating. In Burundi, they tend to eat with their fingers because cutlery is a luxury that most of them cannot afford. It's hard for me to really describe the level of poverty in these areas. There are, in a family of four or six or eight, there will only be probably two spoons, and that's to use for cooking, and everything else is just done, you eat with your fingers. And so that's what these men and this lady are doing here. And they also make do with practically no furniture. A bench, a table and chairs is a luxury that not everybody can afford. So as you saw the ladies in the previous slide, they spend a lot of time just sitting on the ground. This is the main hall that we have put up in Mugina. This is about an hour to an hour and a half's drive out of the capital city. And this is the largest of all the halls that we built. And we made this one especially large because it's the largest congregation that we have. And also, this is what they use for the Feast of Tabernacles. So we would probably be able to put about 200 of Westerners in this hall comfortably. They can get 500 in there because they're on the diet that they have, they're very, very thin people for the most part. So this was the group that was there on the Sabbath day when I was able to meet with them in August. Then there was a night flight from Bujumbura up to Kigali in Rwanda. And this is what Rwanda looks like. You'll notice Rwanda has really made great strides to the point now where you have helmets when you ride a motorcycle. You don't see that in the rest of Africa. But after the genocide that occurred in 1994, the government that took over under the current president, he's been either president or vice president since that time, Paul Kagame is his name, he's a man who got some military training in the United States, and he's also a man who has really tamped down on the corruption. One of the things that keeps Africa so desperately poor is the level of corruption at just about all levels of the government. A lot of money just goes straight into people's pockets, and as a result of that, Western aid agencies and Western governments are very careful with the amount of aid that they give to most of these very poor countries because they want guarantees that it's actually going to serve a useful purpose, not just line pockets. Paul Kagame in Rwanda has really kept the corruption level low, and as a result of that, countries have been extremely generous in their outpouring of aid to Rwanda, and it's been used very, very well. So the town of Kigali has just blossomed. It looks completely different than it did in 1996 when I first went there. In 1996, it was only 2 years after the genocide. The infrastructure had been completely destroyed, and it was almost back in the Stone Age. You saw lines of women and children carrying water. There was no electricity outside the main city, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when you go to Kigali, it's one of the more modern cities in all of East Africa. Some of the stories about what Mr. Kagame has done to limit the corruption level are rather interesting. One story that stuck with me was he started noticing that government ministers were driving Mercedes-Benz around town, and he knew that that wasn't in their budgets to do that. So he knew he wasn't paying them enough to buy their own Mercedes-Benz either, so he figured there was some corruption going on, and indeed there was. So he got his special police, and they made a pre-dawn raid on the residences of all of the government ministers who were seen driving Mercedes, and he simply took the Mercedes away and auctioned them off at the local marketplace. And the message was, if you want to be a minister in my government, you stick to your budget, and I don't want any corruption, and I don't want you riding around in Mercedes-Benz cars. So that's what it's taken for there to be really some good development in Rwanda. These guys have milk cans on the back of their bicycles. There's a little glare from the dashboard there, but they're hitching a ride by holding on to a truck in front of them. Not the safest way to get around, but I guess if you're going up a hill, you'll give it a try. These are four of our volunteers. One of the things that we did while we were in Rwanda, I may have talked to you about this program before, but Foundation Outreach International this was the second year that they sponsored a dual program of outreach for our church brethren in Rwanda. And it's, as I said, dual. Part of it is providing dental care to our church brethren. Dr. Greg Schwartz, who you may know, is a dentist. He's also an elder in the church. And he visited Rwanda with me in 2004 and just fell in love with the people. So he's dedicated a lot of his time and a lot of his money to helping out in this area here. He's established some very good relationships with local dentists. In fact, he's so well known in Kigali, they just call him the American dentist. That's all I have to say, and everybody knows who they're talking about. He's been invited to their Congress. He's been given tours around by government ministers. He counts them as his friends. He's just very well connected, and it's been a wonderful reflection on the work of the church. So Dr. Schwartz goes, and he takes care of whatever the dental needs of our church brethren might be, and then he also works with local dentists to train them or to improve their abilities, improve their capacity to serve. So they save up the really hard root canals for him, and then he does those when he goes. And he's brought over entire containers full of dental equipment that he's left. He's stocked a couple of hospitals with dental chairs, the whole big setup that you would have when you go into a dentist office. And this year he had two other dentists who helped him. Those are the two young women in the middle of this photo. They are both dentists, Sharon Mundo and Verlaine Chopin. The Chopins live in New Zealand now, originally from the Philippines. Andre Chopin on the left, he is in IT, but he came to teach the other side of the program, which is to teach English. A few years ago, Rwanda decided it wanted to change from having French as its dominant European language to English. And so anybody who has even a little bit of English really has a leg up as far as opportunities are concerned. So this is the second year in a row that we've had two teachers go in and for a whole week, 5 days in a row, give introductory classes or more advanced classes. We break them into two groups now in English. How do you teach English to people when you don't have a language in common with them? That can be a challenge. There's a lot of repetition. There are a lot of pictures. And actually what they've started doing, they've organized the English classes around our hymnal. And they'll take a couple of hymns, they'll go through the vocabulary, showing pictures, etc. And then by the end of the week, they actually sing one of the hymns in English as special music. This is from people who didn't know any English before having these classes. So it's been a very encouraging program for them, and for some of the young people in particular, it really is giving them a leg up as far as opportunities in life. So we really appreciated these volunteers. Sharon Mundo is from Guatemala. The Chopins came all the way from New Zealand. And then Isabella Slaughter is from North Carolina. Sorry. And here they are at work. That's Dr. Schwartz in the back there. We had three dentists working this time, which was very, very good. And our female dentist especially liked working with children, which was great, because that can be a little bit difficult when it comes to dentistry. I should tell you the story. The first time that I came to this very dental clinic as part of the university hospital system, when Dr. Schwartz and I walked in to try to meet some of the dentists, we heard people screaming down the hall. Because when you go to the dentist here in Rwanda, you have to pay in advance for everything that's going to be used, including painkiller. So when a lot of people come in, they don't have the money to pay for that. They can just pay for the procedure, but they don't have enough money for a shot. They just do it without any painkiller at all. And when we heard these people screaming in their chairs, Dr. Schwartz said, I got to try to do something about this. And so one of the very first things that he started bringing in was a lot of Novocaine and things of that nature to try to ease the pain. Our dentists also give out toothbrushes and toothpaste, and they explain how to use them and the proper techniques and all of that, and it's really made a difference. Dr. Schwartz has been going since 2006, off and on. There was a hiatus in the middle there, but it's really been a wonderful boon to our church brethren and even to the dentistry level in the whole country. Here's Isabella, some of the English classes. They bring several big suitcases full of materials in so that the students can have paper and pencils and vocabulary cards, and they really try to do the best they can for them. That's a very effective program. There's Andre doing the same thing. So it's not our primary mission in the church to do this kind of thing. Our primary mission is to preach the gospel and to take care of God's people. But as we're able to do a little more, then we try to do that. And this is one of the programs that the church is backing. FOI is doing a lot of good in other parts of the world, providing scholarships for students to go to school and providing English classes where needed and dental help, etc. There's really a lot of good being done by this charitable organization. We also provide meals for them. We have to put them up for the week while they're in classes, and it's a buffet. Most people in this part of the world eat one meal a day. They eat one good meal a day, and that's enough. And so they're used to eating as much as they are allowed to eat, and even if they have two meals in the day, actually they have three meals when we provide them, they have a little something for breakfast and lunch and dinner, they really go after it. So it's, some of them, I think, must have an engineering background, because it's amazing how much they can get on one plate. You're seeing some of that there now. And sometimes they seem like very slight people, but they can really put it away. We did take a part of 2 days, part of one day and part of the next day, to take our volunteers out to see some of the really beautiful wildlife that you can see in Rwanda. This is the park, Volcanoes National Park, where it's one of the few places left in the world where you can see mountain gorillas. And we wanted to show them, take them up to visit the mountain gorillas. That's really an amazing experience. But they've priced us out of the market now. When I first went up to see the gorillas years and years ago, it was $250, which already was a lot for me. Then it went up to $500. Now it's over $1,000, about $1,500 to spend 1 hour with the gorillas. When the rangers take you up into the mountains, you cut your way with a machete through the bamboo forest. When you make contact with the gorilla troop, they start a stopwatch, and you've got exactly 60 minutes. And after that, you have to go, because they don't want to bother the gorillas to the point where it would cause problems as far as reproduction and things of that nature. So we were not able, obviously we couldn't pay that much to take them up, but they are branching out. And there's a species of monkey which is endangered that you can also see in the same forest. So that's what we took them to see. This is one of the volcanoes that's right on the border of Uganda and Rwanda and the Congo. And that's the area where those mountain gorillas still exist. So this is Isabella. This was fresh. These were fresh elephant droppings right where we entered in the forest. So we knew that there were elephants around. In fact, the ranger said, yeah, he's just up the trail here a little bit. The rangers are armed, but I don't think they would shoot the animals. The animals are worth more than we are now because they're so scarce, so I'm not sure what they would. Actually, they said they could just fire in the air and it will scare them off. That's what they do. So anyway, this is Isabella with some elephant dung. And I don't know if you can see, but back in these bamboo forests, this is where the gorillas live, and this is also where the golden monkeys are found. And so we were able to get up quite close to them. They're habituated to people. They're wild, but because they see tour groups come through every day and the people never hurt them or bother them, then they pay no attention to us. So you could get up very, very close to them, and they wouldn't really pay much mind, which was quite fascinating. And it was a very special trip. So here's Dr. Schwartz again. Now he's on the banks of Lake Kivu. Lake Kivu is one of the African rift lakes. This was pretty close to where we were with the monkeys. And we wanted to spend a night here and show them the lake also. This is an interesting lake. It's one of the methane lakes in Africa. You may have heard about this before. But in areas of volcanic activity, methane seeps up from the ground and it stays along the bottom of the lake. And every once in a while, every 1,000 years or so, there will be a phenomenon where it turns over. And the methane will come up and spread out, and it will kill anything that's along the shores of the lake because it displaces the air, and anything that breathes will suffocate. This has happened in Cameroon a few times just recently. It's not happened on this lake for hundreds of years, so we didn't feel too in danger to show them, but we did take them down to this lake. There's a factory here that's siphoning the methane off the floor of the lake, and they're using it to fire the furnaces in their factory. So it's quite rather ingenious. Here we are out on the lake. This was a little island that we came to. They explained to us that this used to be the place where they would maroon unfaithful wives. So if you're caught cheating on your husband, they would just take you out here and leave you. Nobody knew how to swim in the old days. So they would leave you out here, and then the Congolese would come over and pick them up and take them off to the other side of the lake. And I suppose, marry them or something. But anyway, that was kind of an interesting little bit. Fishermen's boats. And so these are the people who were helped by, all of these people were treated for dental problems or maintenance. This is the number of people that we're able to treat in about 10 days. And these are just the church members. There are many other people who were treated also through these means. And these are the ones who participated in the English program. And it was just, it's very, very encouraging. The members there in Rwanda are very encouraged to have people come from far away, from the wealthy part of the world, as they look at it, to come and help and serve them. So it's been very encouraging to them. Next stop, you probably can figure out where this is. I flew from Africa up to London, and this is where we were going to have the International Leadership Program. You can see a lot of really interesting things in London. I arrived a day earlier than everybody else, so I had the chance to go around and look at a few things. And then the team from Dallas arrived a day early as well because airfares were less expensive. And so we were able to visit some historical sites. Like this is the War Cabinet Rooms in London. This is where Winston Churchill had his cabinet meetings during the Blitz when the Germans were bombing London. It's under a very large sheet of concrete, very close to where the Parliament building is now. And they've set it up to look just the way it did during World War II, 1939 and 40. You can also find some very, very old things in London. This restaurant here is one of the oldest. This is so old that William Shakespeare used to stand up there on the balcony and watch his plays performed in the courtyard down below. So that's about around 1600. This has been there since then. And we were able to have a meal there. It's actually not that expensive. It's just kind of a pub. And we also went to the British Museum. I don't know how many of you had the chance to go there, but if you're ever in London, one of the premier historical and art museums in the world is the British Museum. Entry is free. And what's especially interesting about the British Museum is that they have a lot of things that are connected with the Bible. A lot of archaeological excavations have been done on biblical sites, and you can find those in here. For example, this is the Cyrus cylinder, which you may have heard about. This was a cylinder by King Cyrus of Persia explaining that he let people go back to their... When he took over Babylon, he let captives go back to their lands and rebuild their temples. Just exactly what's mentioned in the Bible about Ezra and Nehemiah being allowed to go back. So this is confirmation of something that we have written down in the Bible. This is a panel from Nebuchadnezzar's throne room, or his palace, I should say. So this, the Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible, this was a decoration in his palace. So we can be assured that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walked by this panel many, many times over the course of their careers. Very interesting to think about some of those things. This is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser, one of the Assyrian kings. What's interesting about the black obelisk of Shalmaneser is that it is the earliest depiction of a biblical character that we have. So this dates from 840 B.C., and it shows an Israelite king, King Jehu, bowing before Shalmaneser because the Israelites had been taken captive or dominated by the Assyrians. And his name is mentioned, that he came from the house of Omri, one of the kings mentioned in the Bible. So this is also quite a fascinating confirmation of things that we have written in the pages of God's Word. We'll come back to the British Museum in just a moment, but let me show you some of the leadership weekend. This is what it looked like. We had people from Switzerland, from France, from the UK, from Germany, and from Estonia were here to participate in this weekend, and one from Greece as well. So it was quite an international group. Mr. Franks speaking. He's in front of a green screen so that video can be touched up and put on the leadership website, which the church has prepared. And it was a wonderful time for fellowship, renew some old friendships. And this was the group that was present for the leadership weekend that we had. It was off to a very, very good start. Discussions are underway now for the continuation of this program. I think Mr. Franks has explained this already, but let me just repeat it. We're facing a near crisis in people being able to serve in the church. And we're a lot better off here in the States than most international areas are. So we're making a concerted push to find people who are capable of service and willing to serve, and we're trying to stimulate them and bring them up to speed and equip them so they can serve in their various local areas. We have the need is even more dire outside the United States than it is in the U.S., and so this is a wonderful effort that's being made to help those people and to help those areas. We very much appreciate it in the French regions. Okay, I'm just going to throw in a couple of parenthetical thoughts here. This doesn't really have anything to do with anything, but you might find it interesting. I've had on my bucket list for some years to visit Iceland, and so I flew up after the weekend in London and spent a couple of days there. This is Reykjavik from the sea. This is what the land looks like. No trees unless they've been planted by people. There are no native trees to Iceland, very volcanic. This was the place where the first parliament was ever built, or held, I should say. It's called the Althing. And it dates from around the year 1100, and it's the oldest continuously functioning parliament in the world. It's wonderful, really amazing waterfalls from the melting glaciers. This is the very first geyser, named Geyser, and the reason we call it Geyser is because they used to give names to these spouts that spouted up out of the earth. The first one that was ever written about in print in Europe was Geyser. And so the Europeans said, oh, that's a geyser, and now that's why we call them all geysers, is because of this geyser. And I was there when one went off. You're probably wondering, if it gets on you, does it burn you when it comes down? I was wondering about that. When it went off, there's no warning when it goes off, it just goes off. And I was standing close enough that the water fell on me after it came back down. It was cold by the time it got back to me. So it's boiling when it comes up out of the ground, but it was pretty pretty cool air. And I had some reindeer for dinner one evening. That was interesting. Okay, I'm going to close that parenthesis now. And which one of these will blank out the screen? Bottom one, top one? Can you blank the screen? Let's see. Let's give it a try. Okay, that did it. All right. I want to switch gears now. And we'll show a few more slides here in a moment to illustrate what I'm talking about. One of the things that has probably struck you as I have showed these slides is how poor the conditions are comparably to what we expect and what we live in. Our brethren in many parts of Africa live in what we would consider dirt and poverty. There is crime. You have to worry about persecution from the government watching over your shoulder all the time. Some of our brethren have lived through genocides, certainly those in Rwanda and Burundi have. I've mentioned to you before, they don't have the same life expectancy that we do in the West. In fact, most people in the countries where I just showed you, they have a life expectancy of 20 to 30 years less than we do. So they may not get to see their grandchildren, for example. Nobody ever gets to see their great-grandchildren. That just doesn't happen. We get to watch our grandchildren grow up, and like I said, oftentimes we'll even get to see our great-grandchildren. But every day, these brethren of ours are trying to do the same thing that you and I are doing. They're looking forward to the kingdom of God. They're trying to grow in character. They're trying to give their children a good start in life. They're trying to teach their children God's way so that they can be a part of the church in their turn. They're trying to do the same things that we're trying to do, but they just have much more difficult circumstances in which to do it. And I can assure you that these people pray every day with great intensity, "Thy kingdom come." And I always ask myself that question. I wonder if I'm praying that as intently, as seriously as what they are. How much do we really want that to happen? It would be good for us to pray with the same intensity that they do. The world is not a good place, and it's getting worse. I don't need to tell you that. Start turning, if you would, to Isaiah 59. We'll see something that Isaiah said about the world of his time, and it's becoming increasingly that way in our time now, too. Isaiah 59. I'm sure probably the older you are, the more you shake your head when you see the direction that our own country is taking here. The political zoo in Washington and the lack of civility and the grossness and coarseness of people's language that's just considered normal now. And, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have to worry too much about locking our doors if we left the house. We don't ever go out without locking our doors now, and people are putting up cameras and burglar alarms because our world is becoming increasingly violent, and there's less and less trust that we can have in other people. This is the way Isaiah described his time. See if this rings a bell. "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that he cannot save, nor is ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies, your tongue has muttered perversity. No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. They hatch viper's eggs and weave the spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed a viper breaks out. Their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity, and the act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their path. The way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their ways. That really rings a bell for me. We see our own country, which is one of the few sort of semi-safe places left in the world, sliding down a path of depravity and violence. And it's terrible. That's the world today also. We know, brethren, that we have hope in looking past today toward the future. That's the same thing that Isaiah did. It's quite interesting when you look at the times in which Isaiah lived and some of the things he would have seen, and then you see how many heartening prophecies about the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God, God let Isaiah see. He lived in extremely troubled times. He was talking about his own time there in Judah. And one of the things that we saw in the British Museum concerns a period that Isaiah writes about also. Turn back to Isaiah chapter 36. Isaiah 36. Isaiah lived through a time of war, and he saw it up close and personal. And there are vestiges of that and reminders of that in the British Museum, and I'll show you that in just a moment. Isaiah chapter 36, verse 1. It came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Now that brief, laconic statement there doesn't really do justice to the immensity of the bloodshed and the suffering that would have occurred to take all the fortified cities of Judah. Now we do know from other passages here that God delivered Jerusalem, but he didn't deliver all the other fortified cities in Judah. Isaiah was, according to Jewish tradition, of noble birth, and he lived in the nation of Judah in the 8th and 7th centuries B.C. Around 701 B.C., a great Assyrian army sent by Sennacherib swept through the Holy Land. They had already taken over Syria, Israel, Judah's neighbors to the north, and now they were coming for Judah. And as we just read here, it says very succinctly, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the walled cities of Judah and took them. He conquered them. Underlying those few words were long, long periods, months of siege warfare, and people getting so hungry that they would eat almost anything, eating dead carcasses of animals. Sometimes it even got to the point of cannibalism. There are lots of examples of that that we read about in the Bible. There was agony. Months of fighting in places like probably the last of the fortified cities to fall in Judah would have been the town of Lachish. And interestingly enough, Lachish is just a short distance from Jerusalem. I've had the privilege of visiting Lachish a couple of times, actually. And I'll show you some interesting things that you can see on the site of the excavations of Lachish. But let me show you some of the things that we saw in the British Museum. See if I can turn this back on. Okay, can you start that program up for me again? And I want to get back to that sign that talks about Sennacherib. A little bit more. A little more. There's a museum sign that talks about, yeah, a little bit more. Keep going. Or if you put it on play, I can find it myself. Start the slideshow. Time warp. Keep going. Keep going. Okay, right here. So here we have an exhibit that was taken from the palace of Sennacherib in Assyria, what is today Iraq. When you hear talk of Mosul, you'll hear about that Iraqi city sometimes, Mosul or Mosul. That was the area where the capitals of Nineveh was located, where the capitals of the Assyrian Empire were located. One of the most interesting exhibits is these wall panels that show the siege of Lachish. So this is the Assyrian depiction of what that warfare would have been like. And you can see those are arrows that are flying and clouds through the air. You've got archers that are crouching down behind shields, shooting up at the walls. You have people up on the walls who are using ladles to pour water on places that have caught fire on top of the wall. This gives a very intense depiction of what happened there. Here we have people, captives being led away. We have other people who have been impaled on pikes. We have people coming up and down, back and forth in the city. There's some kind of siege machines that are being used as well. And you can see men up on the top of the walls shooting back down. Here are soldiers taking out whatever they pillaged from the town. They carry away anything of value. And this is probably one of the most gripping ones. These are men being flayed alive. They're having their skin ripped from them while they're still alive. And the Assyrians were famous for doing that. It was a kind of terrorism. Stories got told, if the Assyrians come and if you resist too much, your leaders will face this. And they were famous, and they glorified themselves in it. They were bragging about what they did. This is what Lachish looks like now, or at least recently when I was, that's actually been quite a few years ago now, the last time I was there. But this was one of the entrances into Lachish. It's been quite fully excavated, so you can walk around on the inside, you can see where the walls were, and most interestingly to me, you can see this ramp. This was a siege ramp that was built by the Assyrians almost 3,000 years ago, and it's still there. And what is very striking about this is you see this siege ramp coming up outside the wall, but when you go on the inside of the city, you see that another ramp was being built there as well. And it was a race to see who could build the higher ramp. The Assyrians wanted to get to the point where they could get into the city. The Jews on the inside were building a ramp up on the inside so that there would always be higher up against that wall to keep the Assyrians from being able to come in. And it just was very gripping to me to see these depictions in the British Museum, to actually walk around on this site, and then to try to imagine what it would have been like to be in those cities or to know people who were. Isaiah, as we've said, was of noble birth, and he knew people, certainly knew people, in the walled cities of Europe. He probably had relations or friends that were in those cities and were finally taken away, never to be seen by him again. It's very probable that from the walls of Jerusalem, Isaiah would have watched the smoke that would have come up from Lachish when it burned, as it always did. There's always a layer of ash that you find when you go there. It would have been visible to Isaiah in Jerusalem. And as I said, even though God ultimately delivered Jerusalem from the Assyrians, that joy of being delivered would have been tinged with a lot of sorrow, because a lot of friends and family members and countrymen would have been killed or taken away into captivity. That was the world of Isaiah. And I find it especially striking that in that time of war and suffering and torment, God gave some of the most encouraging prophecies about the future. God allowed Isaiah to look beyond the time of trial and testing that he was in and see wonderful times to come. Now, with all of that as background, we know what Isaiah, we know a little bit more about his time. Let's read some of those prophecies. I think they may take on a little bit of a different feel for you now. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4. I can be sure that Isaiah longed for the time when these prophecies would be fulfilled. He shall judge between nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. This is talking about the Prince of Peace. He was going to come, he is going to come and bring peace. He's called the Prince of Peace elsewhere in Isaiah. And it says in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, Isaiah 9, verse 6, "Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Those were promises given to Isaiah so that he could look beyond the terrible trials of his time. And I would submit to you, brethren, that the world in which we live now, our age, is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And just like Isaiah had to keep his eyes on that reward to come, that promised time, that's going to be more and more important for us as well. Not to get bogged down with the day-to-day tribulations that we face around us, the hostility that we feel from people who reject Christianity completely and call the Bible names. And it's going to get worse. There is going to be persecution. Isaiah never saw those prophecies fulfilled, but he knew that they were there. And that may be the case for us. We may not see them fulfilled in this life. We will see them fulfilled, if not in this life, certainly in the life to come. But as for now, the world is still in upheaval. During the time that I'm talking to you in this sermon, people are going to die in various conflicts around the world. Some will die of malnutrition and starvation in North Korea. Others will be caught up in various conflicts. Children are going to die of violence in this world. But the promises revealed to Isaiah will be kept. It says in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 9, "The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform it. They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And that's a promise for the whole world. Isaiah chapter 26, verse 12, Isaiah says very confidently, "Lord, you will ordain peace for us." He had those promises for the future. And interestingly, Isaiah was given a prophecy to see that must have seemed impossible to him when he received it, because he had just seen the damage, he'd seen the hatred and the cruelty of the Assyrians, and then God gave him to see a rather breathtaking prophecy about the future in Isaiah 19. Isaiah 19, verse 23. Isaiah 19:23, "In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians." Serve who? The God of Israel. Isaiah had seen what those Assyrians could do, how cruel they were, how heartless they were, how they tortured people. But he was given a vision of a time when they're going to be serving the true God. "In that day Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." Quite an amazing prophecy. Egypt and Assyria were traditional enemies of Israel, and sometimes Israel, or the land of Israel, was even a battleground where the Assyrians and the Egyptians would fight each other. But one or the other of them would dominate usually, and they would end up dominating Israel and Judah throughout a lot of their history. And here he's given a wonderful prophecy. Those people who hate you, who dominate you, who kill you and your children, they're going to be changed. And they're going to come and worship with you. They're going to worship the true God. That may have been really hard for Isaiah to grasp, don't you think? I think it would have been amazing when he was given that prophecy. Really? Really? That's going to happen? The world is really going to be a changed place. For generations, Isaiah and his people had suffered under the hand of the Assyrians. Every few years, they would come back and try to take more territory. Their memories bore the scars of the cruelty and the suffering that they had seen. But God also gave a better vision of the future. And those are wonderful words to think about, because if it can happen with the Assyrians and the Egyptians, it can happen with the North Koreans and the Russians and the Chinese and the Palestinians and the Saudis, all the groups that are involved in terror or war or they're angry with our nation, and that's all going to come to an end sometime. And in Isaiah chapter 26, another amazing prophecy was given, Isaiah 26, verse 19. And I imagine when Isaiah was given these prophecies, he had real people come to his mind that he had seen killed or that he knew had been taken away into captivity and died there. This prophecy says, "Your dead shall live, together with my dead body they shall arise. Awake and sing, you who dwell in dust, for your dew is like the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead." The earth shall cast out the dead. That's really an amazing thing. And I'm sure that he had faces come to mind when he was given this prophecy, just as sometimes you and I do think of our grandparents or great-grandparents or friends who preceded us, and we know that we're going to see them again. What an amazing time that's going to be. So, where I want to go with all of this, brethren, I think you can see where it is. The world's not going to get any better until Jesus Christ returns. And between now and then, it's going to get a whole lot worse. And so it's going to be doubly, triply, quadruply important for us to keep our minds focused on those prophecies, those promises that God has given us for the future. They will help give us the courage we need to continue on for as long as it takes until God has finished with his plan and he sends Jesus Christ to the earth. So we have a lot of work to do between now and then. We work together as a church to preach the gospel. We have work to do in our own lives as well, but it's going to be more and more important for us to keep our minds focused on that future promise.